Hello, and welcome Alex's sociology classes. This is our podcast for week four. We will be covering Max Weber, and specifically his works Bureaucracy and the Types of Legitimate Domination. Now, for this podcast, we have two classes joining us. We have my sociological theory students, and we also have my introduction to sociology students. And for those of you who are listening to this who are in one of my classes, I will be posting the slides that accompany this podcast on your respective Learn page. So if you're listening to this at home in front of your computer, you can be watching the slideshow along with me from home. You don't necessarily have to do that in order to get something from the podcast. So let's dive into the material for week four. We'll be talking about a third of our classical social theorists. So we've covered Karl Marx, we've covered Emil Durkheim, now we're covering Max Weber, and then next week we're going to cover American sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois. Max Weber lived from 1864 until 1920. So if you're following along on the slideshow, we'll go to the second slide. So German social scientist Max Weber was brilliant, methodical, and prolific. He had a lawyer's knack for making a clear, compelling argument, and a philosopher's rigorous commitment to defining his terms and using them in consistent ways. And hopefully, if you've done your reading before listening to this podcast, you will have seen that in your text. Methodologically, he was among the first practitioners, along with contemporaries like our other classical theorists, and proponents of applying scientific principles to the study of society. He was and remains influential in all of these areas, but we must choose just one. Within sociology, Weber is known largely for these two ideas. His Protestant ethic thesis from his book The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, and his rationalization thesis. Our readings from Max Weber for this week focus on the rationalization thesis. I've posted a video link on your Learn page with an overview of Max Weber's life and work. It includes a good summary of the Protestant ethic thesis. So you can watch that video if you want to know more about the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, which if this was a full 16-week course in normal circumstances, we certainly would read the Protestant ethic. It's considered a very important text for sociologists. So Max Weber himself is part of the same German-speaking intellectual world of Karl Marx, but he belongs to a slightly different intellectual lineage. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which I often use for background research and recommend to you all as a resource, describes the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism as a non-Marxist genealogy of capitalism. But I think there's some disagreement around just how original his thesis there is in terms of how much he really diverges from Marx in his explanation of the origins of capitalism. So if you're curious about it, that's something you can watch the video and read for yourself. One thing that stands out about Weber is his use of culture. So religion, beliefs, ideas, modes of thinking, trends towards things to understand social, political, and economic phenomena. And you can see that in the two excerpts of his work that you read for today. So let's go to slide three if you're following along at home, titled Rationalization. So I've chosen to focus our short study of Weber on his theories of rationalization for two reasons. Number one, this is a prominent theme across several of his major works, and it's central to making sense of Weber's thought, both in its own context and in the ways it is applied by contemporary scholars. And secondly, it's among the theories that I find most readily applicable to many aspects of contemporary life. which is a fact that makes it useful and interesting to study for both aspiring social scientists and students pursuing other fields, including business, medical fields, legal and government careers, architecture, even music, retail, and service sector work. So we are going to talk about how Weber defines rationalization, and then we'll look at how he interprets both bureaucracy and rational legal authority as manifestations of rationalization. We'll also use a concrete example from everyday life to help make sense of what rationalization means for society and how it defines modern life. So let's go to slide 4. What does Weber mean by rationalization? As with our other classical thinkers, we can see Weber as living and thinking during a time of great historical change. The rise of industrial capitalism throughout Europe, the genesis of a global economy, the origins of global financial markets and investing in the futures of certain industries, advances in the laboratory sciences and medicine, and the application of all of these technological shifts to warfare and colonial expansion. So World War I in particular occurred during Weber's life. He's kind of like that cynical person in your high school history class who looked on the whole world and everything in it as part of the machine. So we saw that Marx understood this time of transition in terms of a change in society's mode of production. That is, in terms of economic forces, labor, and class divides. Durkheim saw the transition in terms of an increasing complexity in the division of labor and declining influence of religion as a force that regulated individuals and bound them to other members of society. Weber sees the defining shift of modern life as a trend toward ever-increasing rationalization. Rationalization itself, for Weber, is a trend towards three things. Those three things are efficiency, calculability, and predictability. When we think of the technological innovations that informed Weber's theory, of course we might think of something like the assembly line production that we've seen our other classical thinkers engage with. This idea of efficient mass production of certain goods by dividing up the tasks among many laborers, each working on a discrete task, perhaps with the aid of a technological innovation, a machine. We should also be thinking, in terms of technological innovations that inspired Weber, of innovations like the science of accounting, or having train schedules to be able to predict when people and goods will be arriving or departing a given location. You can also see these principles embodied in the scientific method, and all of the many industries and disciplines that have been influenced by laboratory sciences. More on this later. Let's go to slide 5, rationalization of administration. So rationalization, efficiency, calculability, and predictability extends into the administration of life in legal and governmental institutions and in the production, transport, and sale of goods. So you have bureaucratic management of institutions in both the private and public sector, growing in what Weber characterizes as modern life. And these arise as very efficient ways to administer the machineries of industrial capitalism, both the machineries of production and the machineries of transport and global exchange, but also the machineries of administering an increasing population and an increasing workforce. So think about the examples that you might give to fit Weber's three ideal types of legitimate domination. So those types of legitimate domination are traditional authority, charismatic authority, and rational legal authority. So charismatic authority comes from the personal qualities of the leader. So maybe gravitas, persuasive and moving speeches, a compelling cause that attract a devoted following. So if you're thinking of examples, you'd be right to put figures like civil rights leaders, but also cult leaders and some fascist dictators into this category. When you think about traditional authority, you might think of someone like a hereditary monarch, a king or queen, or even the Pope, whose authority as head of a nation or of the church comes from custom, tradition, or a belief system, or divine right. Rational legal authority derives its legitimacy from impersonal rules and universal principles that are arrived at through reason. So from a system of rules and from a set of principles that often are the justification of that system of rules. But those principles need to be arrived at through a process of reason, whether that is sort of scientific reason or something like a philosophical sort of logical argument for why those rules are the best ones to have or the necessary ones to have. So generally speaking, if you're thinking of examples of rational legal authority, contemporary democracies are the best example of this type of authority. Bearing in mind that these are ideal types, right? So Weber says these three types of legitimate domination are ideal types, meaning he doesn't think you'll find them in reality and that they always mix together to some degree. But we can see what he's talking about, at least in principle, when we look at a system like our own system of government in which the laws and codes and constitutions create roles or offices and then divide tasks and obligations and grant powers of governing to those different roles or offices. In theory, whomever is serving in those roles has power because they are in the role. And they are supposed to apply the impersonal rules and principles impersonally. This tends not to happen all that impersonally in practice, but when it does, we really tend not to notice it. So somewhere out there, there's a person with a clipboard inspecting your food and your medicine, enforcing building codes, scheduling flights, and counting the elk to figure out how many hunting permits to issue. The fact that we assume that they're there, doing what they're supposed to, and live our lives as if they're there and have the authority necessary to keep us from getting food poisoning or to keep our garbage from piling up on the street, demonstrates some of the upsides of rationalization of administration. Let's go to slide 6. Rationalization, the good, the bad, and the iron cage. So rationalization is great for mass producing goods, feeding a growing population, managing a large workforce, administering a large government or corporate bureaucracy, reliable transportation infrastructure, but does it have drawbacks? Marx saw drawbacks of the shift to a capitalist mode of production, such as alienation and exploitation of workers. Durkheim theorized that without sufficient regulation by society, people might fall victim to what he called anomie, or a sense of normlessness, the absence of society's values in our individual lives. And Weber, too, thinks that the drive toward rationalization has a downside. He calls this downside the iron cage. So in a book you were not assigned, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, he explains the iron cage in this way. No one knows who will live in this cage in the future, or whether at the end of this tremendous development entirely new prophets will arise, or there will be a great rebirth of old ideas and ideals, or, if neither, mechanized petrification, embellished with a sort of convulsive self-importance. For the last man of this cultural development, it might well be truly said, specialist without spirit, sensualist without heart. This nullity imagines that it has attained a level of humanity never before achieved. So, what does that mean? Let's unpack Weber's iron cage. So Weber thinks rationalization leads to increased knowledge, more control over both nature and the natural world, and human beings, and to growing impersonality. So, yes, Weber theorizes, rationalization will make possible some things that have not been possible before. We can increase our scientific and technical knowledge immensely, and we will need to do that to meet the demands of the drive towards efficiency, predictability, and calculability. But it will also lead to what he calls disenchantment, as things like religion, metaphysics, theology, all of the ways we've traditionally contemplated and been humble and in awe before the mysteries and unknowns of life, those things will begin to be less important in society and will be relegated to this realm of superstition or myth. And I read Weber as interpreting this disenchantment as a loss in the quote that I just shared. You know, he's saying, we don't know who's going to live in the iron cage in the future. But at the end of all of this rationalization, maybe there will be a great rebirth of ideas and ideals. Maybe there will be new prophets. But if neither of those things occur, we might be in a situation that he calls mechanized petrification. So let's talk a little bit about what mechanized petrification might mean. Growing control can be good, as we see in his text, Bureaucracy. It can be an efficient way to administer a big institution. But we can also see the downsides of a society in which disciplined control permeates every aspect of life. Think about people standing in lines, waiting for their number to be called, counting calories, embarking on a scientifically backed exercise regimen. Yes, you can be identified quickly by the government by a number. But on the other hand, you can quickly be identified by a government-issued number. Also, we have a rational legal system of power, for the most part, as we discussed, in the U.S., which theoretically means that officials hold power by virtue of their office, not by virtue of who they are, such as in a system of hereditary aristocracy. So a judge's power comes from the fact that she is a judge. Anyone who holds the role of your boss can fire you or give you a raise. It's not that Larry, your manager at Chili's, was born with the power to pay you more, right? He has that power by virtue of being your boss. Similarly, the governor of your state is the governor because they were elected as the governor, and they have the governor's powers because they're serving the role of governor. It's not the case that, you know, the governor of your state has power because their parent was governor and they inherited the crown, right? That would be traditional authority. And it's also not because they're just an extremely compelling person that they have power. They may have been elected because of some of their personal qualities, but that's not what gives them power as the governor. It's their office and the constitution of our state that gives that person their power. So it's supposed to be the case that as a person in a rational legal society, the law and the rules are applied to you without regard to who you are as a person, right? That's supposed to be the case, and that's supposed to be one of the upsides of this type of system. You're not sort of at the mercy of the king. We also have, as part of rationalization, this drive to classify and systematize, categorize and order everyone and everything, which means that people can be objectified pretty readily or transformed into cogs in the machine or numbers on a spreadsheet, to use a sort of more contemporary mental image. Bureaucracies can be really inflexible. As anyone who's had to deal with the IRS or the DMV or the bursar's office or Comcast customer service can probably tell you. I mean, we've all been there. We've all been on the phone trying to deal with some problem, and the person on the other end maybe completely understands what we need and agrees that they should be able to fix our problem, but they don't have the authority. Or the necessary information is, quote, not in the system. Maybe a fee can't be waived or an exception can't be made to a policy. The mechanisms of rationalization can't be superseded by the know-how or the problem-solving or the goodwill or the beliefs of the person trying to help you. And it's not a matter of you persuading them out of your need or who you are as a person or the exceptional circumstances. It's simply not within their power to help you. That is part of the mechanistic petrification that Weber calls the iron cage. It's that inflexibility of the system. And the inflexibility of the system, despite the fact that we have all of these innovations in science and technology and things like that, the inflexibility of the system may perhaps lead to a lack of innovation in a way that is something of a detriment, even in view of all of the positive things that rationalization might provide. Let's go to the last slide. Slide 7, rationality at the table. Let's take all of these concepts out of the theoretical realm and bring them into our daily lives, right into our homes, in the form of the humble loaf of bread. Many cultures all over the world throughout history have made some form of bread as the staple of their daily meals. It's a symbolic food in many ways, so it's a fitting example. On this slide, if you're following along with the slides, you see a sliced loaf of Wonder Bread in its iconic packaging on the left-hand side. And on the right, you have a homemade sourdough loaf. And this is a homemade sourdough loaf that was actually made in my home by my husband. So these two loaves, I think, illustrate a lot of really important things about Weber's concept of rationalization and kind of bring them home to us in a concrete way. And if we were doing this as a normal face-to-face class, I would actually assign you all to bake your own loaf of bread or batch of tortillas and to compare your experience of that loaf of bread to a store-bought loaf. So let's start with the loaf on the left, the Wonder Bread. So Wonder Bread is essentially a product of rationality. There's all the scientific and technological innovations that had to occur to get that loaf of Wonder Bread into the store. First, we had to figure out how to grow lots and lots of wheat. And that was partially a scientific innovation, partially through government bureaucracy, through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Then we had to figure out how to mill the wheat to remove the germ, the protein part that makes it go bad on the shelf if you keep the flour for too long. So then we had white flour, which means we could make white bread. Then we had to come up with a way to mass produce loaves. So we came up with industrial food production. And industrial food production allows us to churn out Wonder Bread loaves in mass quantities. And these loaves are perfectly soft, perfectly sliced. Every single bite is consistent and tastes exactly how you know it's going to taste when you go to buy this loaf. We've also used scientific and technological innovations to figure out how to make it more shelf stable so it can sit on the shelf at the grocery store or in your pantry for longer. And use scientific and technological innovations to keep restocking those shelves of your grocery store with as much Wonder Bread as we can buy. So there's some real upsides here. This loaf really embodies efficiency, calculability, and predictability. We can produce these very efficiently. We can make lots of white flour, churn out lots of loaves of this bread, slice them up, ship them out, get them into the stores. Very efficient. Calculability, you know exactly how much this costs. You, the consumer, know how much a loaf of Wonder Bread is going to cost, and the producers of a loaf of Wonder Bread can calculate how many loaves they can churn out in a given period of time, how much the price of wheat is, the price of flour, how much it's going to cost them to distribute it, and then they can figure out how much they would need to charge you for a loaf in order to make a profit. They have, you know, marketing costs and all those other things as well. And lastly, you have predictability. I mean, you know what that's going to taste like. You know that every slice is the same. There's really no guesswork in a loaf of Wonder Bread. You have a sense of roughly how long it's going to last once you open it, especially if you don't live in a humid climate. That stuff's going to last a while. And you also have the predictability of the nutrition content of the bread. So you can think of scientific nutrition as another example of rationality. So when you look at the packaging of a loaf of store-bought bread, you have the nutrition information on there. And that information makes calculable and predictable exactly what is in each loaf of bread in terms of calories and sugar and fiber and protein and different vitamins and minerals. And actually, when we first started making, mass producing bread through industrial means of food production, we didn't really know that by removing the germ from the wheat, we were also taking out all of the vitamins and minerals that actually make wheat good for you. So people started to get sick. And we used scientific and technological innovation to figure out what was making people sick, be able to make it in a lab, and then we simply enriched the flour to put those vitamins and minerals and protein back in. And you can see enriched foods all over the place on your grocery store shelves, such as milk that's been enriched with vitamin D, or orange juice that's been enriched with calcium, or cereals that have been fortified with iron. And all of these things, in a sort of trend that's a little bit less prevalent today, but you know, if you ask your parents or grandparents about sort of scientific nutrition and this discovery, this was such an innovation for homes and families because they really were able to rationalize their sort of home economics and say, okay, we have this is our grocery budget, and we want to have a balanced meal for everybody in the family, at least for the dinner meal. At least one meal a day we need to put on the table, a balanced meal. And we've got kids, or we've got elderly people living with us. We have, you know, someone who works in a physical job, and we've got to meet everybody's nutritional needs. And if you go and look at an old Betty Crocker cookbook or Joy of Cooking cookbook, an older edition of one, you know, from the 50s or 60s or 70s, you will see guides to home economics in the front of the book that explain, here's how much milk you should budget for each child per day, and here's how many servings of protein that they need, and if you're feeding, you know, someone who's a factory worker, these are the things that they might need to sustain them in their physical labor. So scientific nutrition made it possible for people to say, how can I spend my food budget dollars to get the most balanced meal for my family possible? And I'm taking a sort of broad, optimistic view of it here. Of course, we now know that there are a lot of problems with that scientific nutrition that people didn't really realize at the time, that getting vitamins and minerals through enriched food wasn't as good as getting it from whole food sources like fruits and vegetables. We weren't cognizant at the time of the degree to which individual food industries had influence over what experts were telling us was good for us to eat. You know, now we have these questions like, well, how many glasses of milk or slices of bread really should we have? What is the deal with the food pyramid? You know, so we've come to question scientific nutrition, but it's important to try to see it for what it was when it sort of emerged as this innovation that could make your meal planning and your household budget efficient, predictable, calculable. And that's where loaves of Wonder Bread came in. And mass production of foods like bread, and then later other sort of commodities like boxed cereals and things like that, you know, these really entered the marketplace at a time when people were really interested in using the conveniences and technologies of modern life to spend less time doing day-to-day mundane tasks like baking bread. Baking bread would have been something that a family member, probably the mother, would have had to do pretty much every day. So it's a huge task, which brings us to the loaf on the right. So I am not a very good bread baker. If you know someone who has taken my classes before, or you have taken a class with me before, you know that I am usually a confident baker, but not when it comes to bread. This loaf of bread is a sourdough loaf, which means that the baker, the noble Dr. Kenny, my spouse, he made a sourdough starter by mixing flour and water and waiting. And he feeds the starter, and then when he's ready to bake loaves of bread, he feeds the starter a lot the night before, and then he starts doing this whole procedure that involves adding flour and adding water and folding the dough and letting it rise, and it takes like 2 days. And even at the end of those 2 days, even if he's really careful, methodical, and specific in what he does, which he usually is, he's a scientist, and he approaches bread baking like a scientist, the loaf doesn't always turn out. So sometimes we have this like amazing loaf that smells so good and it's so crunchy and hot and fresh and put butter on it or jam. And sometimes we have like this burnt flour log. So when it works, it's amazing. The taste of a homemade loaf of bread. I mean, think of times when you've had a homemade loaf of bread or something homemade, a homemade pie or homemade tortillas or just something that you've cooked or a family member or a friend has cooked for you, and just how good it tastes compared to the store-bought version. It's so good compared to the store-bought version that oftentimes we think of homemade things as treats these days. So it tastes really good. And it's really fun to watch the baking process. I think it's sort of something interesting, like a hobby for a lot of people who are sourdough bakers. And once you get the hang of it, it's pretty efficient. We buy these giant bulk bags of flour and we don't need any yeast because we have the sourdough starter. So generally speaking, we've gotten the cost per loaf down to, I don't know, maybe 30 cents, something like that. So you can see how it's really the opposite of the Wonder Bread loaf in terms of how it's made. I mean, a sourdough loaf in particular is really irrational because you don't even measure the ingredients. You kind of just, and if you have a grandparent who bakes, like I have a grandparent who makes biscuits. If you have a grandparent who makes tortillas, watch them do it sometime. They're not measuring a thing. They're just putting stuff in a bowl, and they've done it so many times, they just know how to do it by heart. So even measuring is a sort of rational activity in the Weberian view of rationality. And people who really bake without doing that, it's kind of the opposite of Weberian rationalization when it comes to the baking world. So you got this loaf of bread. It's completely the opposite of the Wonder Bread in the sense of how it's made. It's a little bit different from the Wonder Bread in the sense of what it provides to the person eating it, right? It's a different experience to eat something homemade. Maybe it feels like a special treat. It might be more nutritious. There are some people who think that, you know, homemade breads of different kinds maybe have more nutritional value than the store-bought loaf. It can be a sort of experience of family and sharing. It's considered, you know, a generous gift to bake something for someone or cook something for someone. So it is kind of a way that we kind of commune with each other and share. So some of those values and mysteries of life, family bonds that rationalization doesn't really capture, a homemade loaf does capture. And I have to say that the homemade loaf, as I mentioned, is not very predictable. So you can see the downsides here too. I mean, if you are stretching your family's food budget, you might, unless you're a really great baker, you might not be willing to take the risk of buying the ingredients to bake something if you don't know how it's going to turn out. You know, especially if bread is central to your meal, if you're maybe having bread and maybe a dish of soup, you really can't afford to not have that bread on the table. It's not really a meal if you don't have the bread, if the rest of your meal is sort of modest. So, you know, these are some of the downsides that are so nicely captured by Weber's concept of rationalization. On the other hand, let's think about what Weber says are the pitfalls of rationalization, sort of disenchantment, the iron cage. Think about what happens when I would ordinarily in my lesson, I would say, think about what happens when a natural disaster hits and people make a run on the grocery stores and buy the things they think that they'll need to get through. We don't have to imagine this. We're living this. I go to the grocery store, no bread. Now, there's also no yeast because everybody has decided to learn how to bake bread. And I think it's interesting to think about that in terms of Weber's rationalization and what he says are the pitfalls. You have, when you turn over producing bread to a very efficient bureaucratic system of administering the production of bread within a food company, you have the loss of the skill, of the know-how, of the appreciation of the subtle arts of bread baking. So you have a system in which you have a bunch of people who perhaps cannot or do not think that they can produce this really important staple for themselves. And I think that particularly with something as symbolic as bread, you know, Weber might say, well, what then does that do to our belief system and to our ideals if we suddenly feel that this wonderful technological innovation of producing Wonder Bread has taken away from us this really important traditional skill of being able to feed your family yourself with something that you made by hand. I think that if you kind of look around at the sort of modern homesteading movement or, different movements trying to recapture traditional cultural skills. You can see these as ways of resisting rationalization. People want to recapture some of that enchantment, that magic, that mystery, and also that skill that comes with being able to do these things, which generally speaking, we've handed over to the forces of production in modern life. So something interesting to think about as you go through the rest of your week, as you perhaps do some cooking or some baking in your own home, or as you do your shopping trip, or go through your pantry figuring out what to have for dinner. It's interesting to think about how all of those things got to you and what kinds of skills might have been lost along the way, and how much are you now dependent on the rationalized system that brings you your food in a way that makes it a sort of iron cage, right? Where it's inflexible. You're a little bit trapped by the fact that you kind of don't have all the skills that we in modern life don't have all the skills that perhaps we had before this intense rationalization, which in some ways, you know, leaves us a little bit restricted. And then also think about, you know, just those things, kind of intangible qualities that come with making something or cooking something or baking something from scratch, those intangible qualities that have to do with passing on knowledge from your parents and grandparents, from the generosity and the sharing of a meal, and from the moments when we bring our friends and family together around our tables to mark special occasions or religious feasts, and how there is sort of an intangible something about those that remains a little bit enchanted, a little bit magical, in defiance of the forces of rationalization. So, go forth, bake, defy rationalization, and join me back here next Thursday on the podcast for a discussion of W.B. Du Bois, the last of our classical theorists.